This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group, and today we are here with Dr. Jonathan Reichenthal. He's an award-winning technology leader whose 30-year career has spanned both the private and the public sectors. In 2017, Dr. Reichenthal was named one of the top chief information officers in the world, and in 2016 was named one of the top 20 most influential CIOs in the United States. He's recognized as a global thought leader on a number of emerging trends, including urban innovation and blockchain technology. In 2013, he was recognized as one of the top 25 doers, dreamers, and drivers in government in America, and his innovative work in government has also been recognized by the White House. He's a popular writer and educator, producing several highly successful online courses with LinkedIn Learning, which is how I got introduced to him, and he also co-authored the Apps Challenge Playbook and is a frequent public speaker on a wide range of technology and business-related topics. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be on here.
Yeah, and you know, I was introduced to you because I was on LinkedIn taking the Digital Transformation Leadership series, and you were the very first one. Your course is called The Foundations of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which I thought was so fantastic, and I immediately reached out to you because I wanted to cover this and its effects on real estate, and the rest is now history. So
that's great. Well, isn't it incredible how we're able to connect these days? I just find it just wonderful that you and I are talking now because of that intersection online. I just think that's great.
I mean, just real quick, have you been surprised about how this LinkedIn course has fared, and have you been getting really good positive feedback?
I have. You know, I've been working with LinkedIn Learning now for several years, and I have a pretty decent cadence of proposing course ideas and developing them now and then having them published. I'm doing two or three per year, which is, given all the other things I'm doing, I think it's about as much as I can do. And I'm trying to really identify topics that are very current and are going to be big game changers in the months and years ahead. And one of the things I do is I check to see, is anybody else doing anything on more broadly on these topics? And then specifically on the LinkedIn platform, which is very popular, is anyone doing anything? If they're not, I want to quickly fill that niche. So, I fell in love with this fourth industrial revolution idea because it's such a great way for all of us to understand the future and the transformations happening in every part of the economy, both to enterprises and to individuals. And then recently I've been working on, and I've just completed a draft of the course on quantum computing, which I also think, by the way, is a subset of the fourth industrial revolution, but in of itself a massive potential game changer as it relates to computing platforms. So the response is really amazing. My blockchain courses, are approaching a million participants. I think, thank you. I think from my research, they may be the most popular blockchain technology courses in the world right now, so I'm just humbled by that.
Well,
but I know we're going to talk about the Industrial Revolution, and I think that this topic is, I feel that it is building in momentum. I got the timing reasonably right, and I think the big boost in this topic is going to be not behind us or currently, but all ahead of us.
I agree.
So I'm getting, thank you.
And, I think it was the perfect, were you aware that they were going to make that as the introduction course into Digital Transformation Leadership course, or did that just happen to fall into place?
I think, I don't think I was, aware of how they might position it relative to their other courses and their learning paths. I'm very happy, of course, and I think it's exactly the right intro course, because it sets the table, for everything that's happening. Everything that's happening from, smart buildings to energy to, the future of public safety and digitization and on and on. I do leave it to my expert colleagues at LinkedIn to position it appropriately and so I'm thrilled that they actually did that.
Well, I agree with your assessment. I think the Industry 4.0 is a broad term that encompasses a ton of technology, and that's I just love the way that you structured the course and framed it. And I think a lot of people may be listening like, this is a real estate show. Why are you talking about Industry 4.0? But I think it's critical because hopefully, I know we'll get into today how this is shaping urban and suburban environments and how it could change potential real estate and the job sector. Some people aren't thinking broad enough and looking at all these technologies coming into play and how it might impact how we live and work. So yeah. I just loved how you framed it. So that's why I was so excited when you agreed to come on.
I just wanted to, if I could quickly, magnify this important point you're making. It's something I try to share at every kind of event I have the possibility to do, or even podcasts and other forums. Is, and that's the words you use, is people aren't thinking big enough. I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges we have with what's ahead of us, is that individuals and enterprises aren't being bold enough and broad enough in how they're thinking about the implications of change. I have the luxury to work with governments and businesses to sort of look at their strategy and help them with their strategy. It's almost always like this. It doesn't fail to present itself as something that is not big enough. Often my recommendation is going to be think bigger, be bolder, take greater risk. And I think that's key in one of the takeaways in this new period that we're entering.
I think you're going to be a very busy guy over the next decade, because I think it's going to happen a lot faster than some think. But let's start at ground zero. How do you quickly define Industry 4.0?
Well, I like to think the term Industry 4.0, comes from the German government. It has been super focused on optimizing manufacturing, Germany being a very successful manufacturing-based economy. But I kind of feel that sort of is a subset of the broader industrial revolution, what we're calling the fourth industrial revolution. And it builds on the transformation that we're in right now, which is a third revolution, which is really the information technology age. The advent of the microchip, it's the use of the internet, miniaturization and use of mobile devices like our laptops, our smartphones, and smartwatches now, and other connected devices. This whole digital world, if you like. And what the fourth revolution is about, and it's only beginning, by the way, is not only that big software piece, but increasing amounts of innovative hardware that we're seeing, and now the intersection with biology. So you see this sort of multi-dimensional intersection of many domains. Also throw into the mix changing global economics, shifting demographics, so you have some nations that the majority of the population is under 25. You have many populations where there's a big aging population, in fact, a shrinking population. You have this idea of, for the first time, less entry barriers for economies all over the world. So I'm real bullish on Africa, for example. I think its time is coming. It's coming soon. And if you're not thinking about Africa, in your plans, you're going to miss a multi-trillion, multi-decade opportunity. Sadly, I think other countries other than America are getting that message sooner than we are. And so we need to be thinking about that. And so those are the sort of big macro areas. But here are the actual dynamics of those areas. Is for each of them greater scope. When a line of code is a change in Silicon Valley, it impacts people all over the world and impacts people instantly. And that also goes for impact. And then the third one is velocity, is the speed at which change is happening. And an example of that is how fast an idea goes from being made available to being adopted by millions of people. And you think about the airplane industry. It took 64 years for 50 million people to travel in a plane. Yeah, that's 64 years. And gradually, as new tech has been introduced, it's got less and less and less. Pokemon Go which still exists today. It took 19 days to reach 50 million people. And so that's the velocity component. And then finally is this idea of convergence. And I use a sort of cliched example, but it's a good one. I think about something like Uber, right? And Uber has this sort of transformational capability for transport. You know, why didn't Uber exist 10 years ago? Well, outside of the fact that, you know, somebody with a great idea had to come up with it. But we also have to have GPS. We also have to have online payment systems. We have to have social networking,
yeah,
crowdsourcing. You know, there's a ton of other tech that has to be in a place where it was, where it could be used confidently and it was stable. And when you converge those things, you create this completely new layer of value. So, you know, people say to me, and here's the challenge again, is why is this all different, you know, from the third revolution or change that's happened in the past? And I said, it is this notion of scope, impact, velocity, and convergence, all happening at rates and scale that have never happened in the history of humanity. And it's disruptive. And by the way, if it makes individuals and enterprises feel uncomfortable, that's probably the right reaction.
I agree. I think one of the things that I've written on it before for Think Realty magazine about the education system, and I was originally introduced to online education the very last year. I was at the New School, traveling the world as an actor out of college based in New York City, and I finished my last year online. And then while I was doing different gigs all over the country and the world, I picked up a set of tapes from to learn Photoshop with TotalTraining.com. And I learned more in 22 hours on those VHS tapes than I did in 3 design courses in college. And I thought when I saw LinkedIn by Lynda.com, and then Microsoft bought LinkedIn, I thought those two purchases were some of the most on-brand purchases. But I'm like, whoa. So yeah. I could potentially take a course from somebody like Warren Buffett. He would be willing to do it because it's backed by something like a Microsoft. He could do it one time, create amazing thought leadership content at scale, and he wouldn't have to teach at a university. But if I'm a university, how would I compete with that?
Yeah.
So yeah. The way that this could change our education system and how that will spill into our living situations and how we work and learn. It's fascinating to me.
It is. I mean, there's a lot to say on that topic and you know, education, it's first of all, look, let's accept it's complicated. But we can recognize a few things. Number one, you know, for a few centuries, it actually hasn't changed that much. You know, you get kids or students into a room, you have someone teach them, you know, they go away, do homework, come back, the homework's graded, whatever. It's a model that's used around the world, and there's a lot of weaknesses. And one of the key weaknesses is not everybody learns the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though we're teaching the same way, not everybody learns the same way. So you have winners and losers. You have some people who prosper in a classroom setting, and then you have some people who don't, and then they see the repercussions of that for the rest of their lives. What's great about the 21st century is you have choices now. You have choices of how to learn through many, many different modalities that actually are better suited to what, you know, works for you. So if you're a person who, I love being in a classroom with a professor, and by the way, lots of people like that. I'm a professor, so I'm happy that people like that. that's good. It's not going away anytime soon. But you have an awful lot of people who want to learn on video. They want to learn at their own pace. They like to read. They like to do sort of like connect on links that take you to a diverse set of different perspectives and different ways of talking about a topic. This idea of online video or on-demand online video in snack length, so I'm talking about not that sort of, you know, 4-hour video that you watch, but like videos that are like 3 to 6 minutes long, and they teach you little pieces of something that when you add them all together, you understand the topic. This is the hottest area right now. In education, it is the fastest growing, the most lucrative area of education because people like it. And whether you're, like you described, you're an individual who sort of does it on their own time, or you are in an enterprise and you have to learn a new skill, you know, you can carve out time on work hours, or maybe you do it on the weekend, whatever is the arrangement. It is exploding in popularity, and it's probably on balance, it seems like a really good thing. It means that, you know, kids have opportunities all over the world to see the same content everyone else does. And you know, that hasn't been always the case. It's more, I guess, there's a little bit more democracy to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I there's a really good book that I read several years ago called Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid. And I think to your point about Africa, some of it, the book was talking about Fortune 500 companies that work in these third world countries and still make a lot of money. But the most fascinating chapter to me was the one talking about bringing in sort of smart technology in the screen. And people may not have consistent sources of electricity, but you put a smart screen in front of them and the user interface is so beautiful, they figured it out quickly. So you're going from an environment that doesn't have consistent electricity, but they can figure out a smartphone and they've just skipped the 30 year of the American experience. So I don't disagree with you that I think some of these third world countries, there's a lot of room to grow because they also are not burdened with bureaucracy. So the fact that you're a chief information officer and you've worked in government, one of my questions, you know, I've spoken to some blockchain leaders and they said it won't happen in the United States first. It's going to happen in third world countries because they don't have anything. And this is, you know, there's a lot of room for innovation because they just don't have the same systems that we've got. So are you seeing that technology in some of these areas might happen faster just because it is filling a void that they don't have any bureaucracy in place?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. I mean, I just wanted to kind of, you know, reflect on a point you made. There really is no such thing as a third world anymore. I mean, in our lifetimes, you know, poverty is went from being about 30% of the world, 30% of the world, to now it's extreme poverty is less than 10% of the world, but it's about 9.5%.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, poverty, extreme poverty being defined as somebody earning about $1.90 per day. And this trajectory is dropping really, really slow. So it's actually a really good news story. And within a, you know, not too long from now, the extreme poverty in the world will be very, very small. I think it's fair to say, though, that any type of extreme poverty is unacceptable. But the fact that it's dropping rapidly is a good news story for the planet. It also means that countries and societies are getting electricity and they're finally getting internet access. So those sort of things that we saw over the last few decades that were real limitations for a decent part of the world are beginning to drop rapidly. It also means that the competitive advantage we have, which you could argue in many cases was unfair, is also going away. So there's no reason why a incubator in Lagos, Nigeria, can't work on and deploy globally a blockchain solution that solves some big problem. Mm-hmm. The same way as an incubator in Silicon Valley here in California could do it. So there is beginning to be more of an even playing field. It's really risky because, you know, now we all have to work harder and so things where, you know, whether it was the United States or Germany or other, you know, well-developed nations had advantages. Now they're going to find that they are really being pushed to compete on the global scale. I think that's good for consumers, by the way, because competition is just healthy generally, and we'll all benefit from that sort of rigorous hyper-competitiveness. There is a deep in your question, though. I think was the point about whether a city which didn't have some sort of, you know, older infrastructure can leapfrog it. And then, you know, be ahead of others. An example of that would be, you know, in the United States, we spent, you know, well over 100 years laying cable, right, to be able to facilitate, you know, the telephones we have and other telecommunication systems. And then in many African nations, they leapfrogged just to a cell infrastructure, cellular infrastructure. So they were able to use better cell technology and not have the burden of, you know, having to support a significant wired infrastructure, although there is always going to be some wired infrastructure. I think they have seen and they have benefited from that. Mm-hmm. But you know, ultimately, it's not going to be just that helps a society move forward. It's multidimensional, and it's going to rely on the political environment. Going to rely on things like available investment, things like collaboration and import-export relationships with neighbors and with the world. There's a heck of a lot of different dimensions that contribute towards whether a city or country prospers in the 21st century. I'm not going to simplify it by saying one or two things. It's going to be very, very complex. But I will summarize and say that we are in a better time now for any city or country in the world to compete against any other. And that's really unprecedented. It's a good news story, I hope.
Okay. Well, and I guess maybe we should start narrowing it down to the real estate field so people don't get lost in sort of the words. So I don't want people to get lost in the technology, but maybe how it might affect. Ardent is a lot of real estate investors and realtors, and I think there are some technologies like blockchain that could definitely interrupt us. But let's go first to how this the industry 4.0 might shape some things. So in your course, you talk about how more people are moving to urban environments. And I think the number was 50% now live in urban environments and eventually 75%. Mm-hmm. Is that the U.S. or is that global?
Global.
So 75% of people will start moving towards urban environments. Was there a date attached to that, like a year?
Yeah, no. So by the middle of the 21st century, so by 2050, over 70% of all humans will live in an urban environment. I mean, again, we have no precedent for this. This is a new day for humanity and the planet. For all of our history to this point, humans have really lived in rural environments. And what's happening now is you see this shift where all humans, most humans will live in a city context. And, you know, the countryside, the farms will have very, very few humans on them. And so we have to adjust to that. And I think, you know, as we think about real estate, I mean, one of the most basic components, there's two basic components that I think about. Well, number one is the significant needs for infrastructure and homes. I'll quote this statistic. I think it's reliable because it's from Bill Gates. He says, you know, for the next 4 years, we're going to build enough real estate the size of New York or Manhattan every month.
Wow.
Right. Yeah, and it's staggering. It's staggering. I mean, the the steel and the concrete and the pipes and the wiring, all the things that go into that are, you know, it'll continue to have massive demand for, you know, foreseeable future for multiple decades. And the second component is, well, it's building an infrastructure that is, if we don't change our design, and fortunately we are starting to do that, they are major contributors towards climate change. As we build more and more real estate, we're having greater and greater impact on the planet, the sustainability of the planet. I also, just on that point, just to kind of talk about it a little further, is, you know, we've typically built a lot of our infrastructure on coastline. Mm-hmm. And our major metropolitan areas around the planet are on coastlines, which, you know, the water's going to rise if we believe the scientific consensus. So we're going to have to build real estate and infrastructure to as barriers and also move some real estate. So, you know, this is going to be one of the most important areas to focus on in the years ahead.
Do you think the definition of urban and suburban, I'm not sure if you're familiar with John Burns. He wrote a book called The Big Shifts Ahead, where he talks about the different generations and where they're moving to and why. And he creates a word called suburban, sort of the, to your point, people moving more towards an urban environment, but suburbs close to an urban environment. But I don't know if I've seen sort of the definition, and this is going to lead into the sort of the smart cities conversation, but just curious, is the definition of urban or suburban changing at all?
So there are some indications of that. You see, for example, the millennials and Generation Y tending to want to live more in an urban environment. You're seeing in many communities, particularly in the U.S., a revitalization of downtown as a place to live. You know, if you think about the last few decades, you know, downtown areas, the sort of center cities, have become ghost towns where people, you know, work there during the day and then 5:30 or 6 if you're looking to get your car and, or you jump on the train and you go out to the suburbs. Now what's happening is you see a little bit of a reversal of that, where the newer generations want to thrive and they're excited by living in that sort of more dense urban environment. It's too early to tell, I think, what the long-term trend look like. Many societies have heavily invested in their suburban infrastructure, and in the U.S. suburbia is still dominant manner in which we live and where commerce happens and where the weekend happens, I guess. So it's one to watch. One of the exciting things is the revitalization of the urban center, making it a place for great restaurants and high rises with beautiful condos, some positive gentrification. But we've got to recognize, there's always a bit of a downside to this. In San Francisco, that sort of gentrification is pushing out a traditional art community that relied on lower cost housing. And there's some pain to this. We perhaps later on we'll talk about inclusiveness and access as major components of the future and why we're probably not doing a very good job of that.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.